This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods, an online and wholesale distributor of heritage breed meat and poultry. Learn more at heritagefoods.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Food is a, you know, a narrative. We're telling stories through food, and this, you know, is probably sounds like hyper intellectualized to most people, but you know, it's why, you know, writing the first book all of a sudden became very easy for me, because when I realized it, I was writing these head notes. It's like every recipe that I'm writing has a story attached to it. There is a thread to a piece of my life. I mean, every plate that I'm taking to the table that I have for all these years that I really didn't understand what I was doing is sharing a piece of my life. And, you know, that is extraordinarily satisfying to me. That's what I love about what I do. And, you know, to go back to, you know, the South, you know, we're incredible storytellers.
That is Chef John Currents of Oxford, Mississippi, our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I'm your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am here with a mystery introductory co-host.
Hi.
Can we have a clue? What do you do for a living, mystery co-host?
I write.
Mm-hmm.
I edit.
Mm-hmm. And you used to?
Review.
And before that?
Cook.
Yes. You, in another life, you could have been a guest on the show.
I could have.
Yes. But not now.
Not now, no.
This is it.
Nope, this is it for me.
Okay, so my mystery guest is Julia Sexton, is it editor-in-chief?
Editor-in-chief.
Of Edible Westchester Magazine. I now live in Westchester. We become pals up here. We are sitting outside. It's almost, we're coming up, we're deep into fall now, but we are sitting outside in front of Antoinette's Patisserie. So because I hate to do intro alone, I asked Julia, since we had a coffee date today, if you would join me for this. So you graciously agreed.
Yep.
And here we are. So our guest this week is John Currents. John Currents is a chef, as many of you probably know, who is based in Oxford, Mississippi. His first restaurant there was City Grocery, which he opened in 1992. That's a long time ago. Doesn't sound like a long time ago, but it's a really long time ago. And he's got several restaurants there now. He has Nacho Mama's. He has Snack Bar. And he has Big Bad Breakfast, which when we sat down for this interview, it was August, and he was sort of promoting that book, Big Bad Breakfast, based on his restaurant. John has been a James Beard Award winner for Best Chef in the South. He's been on television on No Reservations with the late Anthony Bourdain. And on Mind of a Chef, he is a charter member of the Southern Foodways Alliance. He's been with that from the go. He's also a writer, and being from the South, he's written for publications as diverse as Bon Appetit and Garden and Gun.
Wow.
That's unusual.
He gets around.
That's a range. That's what we call a range.
And all out of Oxford, Mississippi.
And all out of Oxford, Mississippi. We met in New York, and I don't know, Julia, how do you feel about it when chefs get political? Does
I like
it bother
it.
You?
No, I think everybody should be political.
You think everybody? Did you always feel that way? Or is this a late 2000 teens sentiment?
No, I think I've always been that way. Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. I don't want to say who. I had a conversation with a very political chef once, and I thanked him for being political because it's someone who's very well-known, very famous.
It's risky.
And he said, do you think I should not do that? And I said, well, I don't know. Like, I was kind of brought up that that's what we do here in the United States. Like, everybody can kind of say what's on their mind.
Right. And why wouldn't you?
And why wouldn't you? So anyway, John is very much out there. We sat down back in August. It was during the hiatus between the summer and fall seasons. And because of the nature of the first 12 minutes or so of this conversation, I decided I would hold it for right before Election Day.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So this is going to drop on the Saturday. And like I said, we're sitting outside the cafe. That was a big old dump truck that just went by. I thought this would be a very appropriate show to air right before Election Day. I hope it inspires people or reminds people to get out and vote on Tuesday.
Please vote.
Yeah, it's really important. I don't even just believe people who believe as I do should vote. I think everybody should vote. I think I believe in all the corny things people say that really aren't corny. Like, a lot of people died so we could vote. A lot of people have struggled so all of us could vote over the years.
And people died.
It's just amazing to me that people are out there begging people who are already engaged to get on the phone and beg other people to vote. I can't believe we have to do that.
We do. We have a swipe left or right culture right now. Yeah. And you have to go to a place.
Yeah, you may have to stand in line.
A school gym. Yeah. And you have to sign a book and fill out a card.
Yeah. So I, months ago, as some listeners may remember, if you have been with me that long, months ago, I got a little political in my introduction to the show. Some people loved it. Some people didn't like it so much. I've kind of begged off it. I just haven't felt like I needed to again. I sort of got it out of my system. But John, this is such a part of who he is that I did engage him on this level. But if it's not your cup of tea, I do want you to know that after, like I said, after about 12, 13 minutes into the interview, we kind of move off that and we get into all kinds of stuff. We get into his background as a cook. We get into time he spent in France. He gives a sort of pocket history of modern Southern cuisine as someone who was there and is incredibly knowledgeable about it. We get into his feelings about awards in the industry. We talk a little about the business of the industry. So if you're put off by the politics, I guess you could zoom through the beginning of it, and we don't come back to that. So I'm just telling people that to try to accommodate all listeners. But I encourage you to listen to it because John is someone who's very thought out about his feelings. I also just want to say before we jump in that I've said this on another recent episode. It's happening more and more that guests on the show mention other chefs and people they know in the industry. And those people are now people who have been guests on the show. So in this interview, John mentions Mike Anthony. He mentions Alex Guarnaschelli. He mentions the late Tony Bourdain, who we did a eulogy show for. And he mentions Mike Solomonoff. Now, with the exception of Tony, the other three have all been guests on the show. So I feel almost, Julia, this is going to sound, this is something I would normally only say to Caitlin, but it's just like my version of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
That's funny.
I feel like we have the Andrew Talks to Chef podcasting universe emerging. It is emergent.
I love it. You have to do a big graphic about this.
Yes, we have to do a graphic that looks like, you know, when they have the mob, like in when the feds have all the connections between the mob figures on the board.
And you're Andy Two Chins.
Exactly,
something, right?
Exactly. But anyway, if you, when you hear John mention those people, if you want to know more about any of them, he probably talks most in depth about Mike Solomonoff. Go through the catalog of episodes. We have an interview with Mike Solomonoff from just a couple of months ago when we were in Philadelphia. Anyway, that is all I have to say about it. Julia, thanks for being here for me.
Thank you.
We didn't talk that much.
This was fun.
It really helps me to have somebody here.
This is a hoot.
Thank you. All right. So we're going to go back to our espressos as we try to elevate the hipster cachet of Hastings on Hudson.
With our microphones on the street.
On the street with our microphones. If we only had someone here with a camera, it would feel like Bushwick, Brooklyn. Okay, that's it. So if you could, imagine me and John Currents back in August at the office of his PR firm on a hot summer day, sitting down to begin the interview. Here you go. You were talking about virtue. Good.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Did this make you shy?
No. It's, you know, it's difficult to talk about these days, you know, without, you know, feeling paranoid that, you know, that I'm climbing up on a soapbox. But, you know, I continue. And this is what, you know, far too many years of liberal arts education will do to you. You know, I studied philosophy and political science. And
did you get all the way to the end of that road?
You
actually got degrees. Not all cooks make it to the finish line that race.
I did. It took me returning to Virginia in the summer of 2001 and moving back into the dormitory that I had lived in my freshman year in 1983.
Yeah.
and living amongst a group of like 16 or 18, 19 year olds.
When you were how old?
I was 35 or 36. Ooh. Yeah. And it was hilarious because I went back and it was without much argument at all. Like it was one of the best vacations I've ever had in my life. So somebody said for 6 weeks, go to your room and read.
Yeah.
And
you wouldn't appreciate that when you were originally there.
Oh God, no. I was a terrible student. I had all the ability, but I just, you know, I think I was probably some form of ADD before diagnosis for that existed. And they just said, you know, kids like me, like they just, the diagnosis would be like, well, he just eats too much sugar.
Careless errors, careless errors. There are all these phrases you hear again.
Right.
We've talked about this on the show though. This is a very common way for a future cook to present as a young student.
Exactly.
Were you a jock?
I played football and football was my love. Yeah. And I played all the way through junior high and high school. And then I went to school in Virginia because I wanted to play football in a little Division III program. But it was far too serious, you know, for me. I'd had fun in high school.
But I derailed you. You were talking about your 2 degrees and how your need to pontificate is like a vestige of all that.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, and maybe that's, you know, why, you know, I have such a, you know, nefarious or, you know, wonderful reputation on social media, depending on, you know, which side of the fence you fall on. Because, you know, I do feel very strongly, you know, about the fact that if we, you know, we have the ability, you know, to, you know, stand on a stage, you know, doing what we do as chefs, that, you know, we have the opportunity to, you know, to affect change.
Yeah.
And that's a responsibility, you know, and what, you know, and I know that everybody sort of that has taken the stance that I have, you know, feels very much the same way in that, you know, we hear continually, you know, why don't you just get back in the kitchen and cook,
totally.
Cook a steak, you know, just do what you do well, like
yeah.
Shut up and cook thing. And the thing that I say is like, I have, you know, at this point, you know, probably 600 or 700 people that I employ. And, you know, if I have the ability to represent them and represent their interests, what does it say about me if I don't stand up and do it?
Yeah.
So I do, whether it's the LGBT community, whether it's minorities, whether it's immigrants, I mean, it doesn't matter to me, you know, I want what's best, you know, for my people.
Right.
And
were you this outspoken pre-2016?
No question about it. I mean, I was very angry, during the Bush years. I felt like there's been a whole lot of misguided energy, you know, which has led to, you know, oddly, like I'm this weird sort of line between social, liberal, fiscal conservative, that, you know, that this misguided energy has led to a whole lot of wasteful spending. You know, that when you look at the, you know, the TSA alone and what we spend to sort of give the appearance that we're making people more safe getting on airplanes when we're not actually.
You mean like taking off your shoes?
Sure.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's the case, you know, why aren't we having to take off our underwear?
Right.
We had an underwear bomber. So,
right.
I mean, it only makes sense.
To me, what's going on right now isn't actually politics. It's transcended that into like a moral existential crisis, right?
Exactly.
And I know there's probably a few people listening right now who are annoyed that I'm doing it again, but what did surprise me was on social media. I got some very angry response when I said this, and I've been very keen to speak to a chef who, like you, I'm dying to talk to Colicchio because his megaphone is so big. But I can only imagine the messages that someone like him gets. Like you must have gotten some very angry, I'm assuming hostile DMs or something over the years.
I've had death threats.
Yeah, I didn't want to say it, but I assumed you must have.
Yeah, I mean, and that really, you know, it's funny that the responses differ sort of from platform to platform.
Right.
There's the greatest amount of vitriol tends to, you know, or venom seems to come through Twitter. I wrote a piece for Kat Kinsman when she was at USA Today about probably 10 or 12 years ago, I think. And it's what was at the genesis point of you know, my relationship with Tony.
Mm-hmm. Bourdais.
Yes. Yeah. That, sorry, I got to remember where we had conversation before we turned.
Yep. It's okay. That's my job.
But that I just, you know, I wrote about the very significant reality of the importance of the immigrant population.
Yeah.
And that it was written so quickly that, you know, it wasn't anything, you know, of any particular substance. But I had a guy in San Francisco who was messaging me, threatening to come kill me and my family.
Yeah.
Just over the fact that, you know, I said that immigrants were an unbelievably important part of our workforce. They were doing the work that people in the United States, for the most part, felt like they didn't have a responsibility to do anymore. They were too good for it. They're above it.
Yeah.
And so somebody else needed to clean up the mess.
Right.
And so, you know, I, Calicchio, Tom and I had breakfast recently, and a tremendous amount of our time was given to talking about this. And, you know, the beautiful thing about Tom, you know, is he's a real tough guy. I mean, he's like Charles Bronson tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't act like it, but, you know, when it comes to how people respond to him, he doesn't give a shit.
No, and hasn't for years.
No, and he's whip smart.
Yeah.
He's articulate.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as a result, his posts are typically are not more than, you know, a handful of syllables.
Mm-hmm.
And they cut straight to the core of the matter. And, you know, and I wish to be that smart. I'm not. I'm just vulgar.
Yes, in prepping for this conversation, I've seen some of your, but what are you going to do?
Right.
It's sincere.
I know. You know, if I had any brains at all, I would listen to my wife, who's one of the smartest people in the world and an incredible editor on top of everything else. And she continues to beat on me. Just like, clean it up. You're smarter than your language sounds. And, but I don't.
Where for you does this imperative to speak out come from? Like, have you always been someone who had a strong sense of justice, morality, speaking your mind? Is that something that your parents instilled in you? I don't think it's the most common quality. I really don't.
You know, I don't know. My,
is it just how you're wired?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, my father is, you know, is wonderfully conservative.
Mm-hmm.
He was an executive in the oil and gas industry,
mm-hmm.
Which is an incredibly volatile, or is an incredibly volatile, you know, industry that, you know, I watched him go through, you know, sort of boom and bust.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he had close friends that went from being millionaires to being flat broke, you know, in, you know, multiple times in their lives.
Yeah.
And so, My father and, you know, he and my brother both, you know, worry about the fact that, you know, that I, you know, I use social media as a, you know, as a platform to speak out.
You mean they fear for you?
As far as, you know, what the effect will be on my business.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was very much raised, you know, to do the right thing for the right reasons,
mm-hmm.
Sort of no matter the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that came from both my father and my mother. My mother was a history teacher.
Yeah.
I mean, was absolutely, you know, a brilliant human being. And, you know, from a character standpoint, you know, was flawless.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she I delivered her eulogy, and the first thing I said is like, there was no question that, like, of the qualities that my mother had, the fact that she suffered no fools whatsoever is one of the most defining. And
it sounds like the way you're describing it, she was one of these people for whom the moment of deciding whether or not to speak about something wrong or something you didn't approve of was not a moment where a decision had to be made. It was just automatic.
Correct.
Yes.
And it was, you know, and it's not that she was anything less than genteel.
Mm-hmm.
She absolutely was, you know, but the characteristic that I I think I most closely associate, having gotten from her was the fact that I literally cannot just make BS polite conversation with right. with somebody that I'm crossways with. Like I am going to tell you how I feel. Right. I mean, and it's, I'm not going to flip you off and, and be ugly about it. But, I just had an exchange with one of my best friends last night, over a text message that I just, that I missed him and I felt like our friendship was neglected. And it does, it doesn't mean I don't love you, but I just got to tell you, I miss you. I miss talking to you. I know that we're both busy, but, we got to remember that friendships are like houseplants and they need an ice cube or a drop of water every once in a while just to keep them alive, but, we got to be better about it. When I do, if I get all the way across with someone, I can't just like walk into a cocktail party mm-hmm. and just play like nothing is going on.
It's so funny you put it this way, because I said to someone not long ago that I reached a point somewhere in my 40s where I felt the need to not have unfinished business with people. And they said, well, how do you measure that? And I said, I would like for there to be no cocktail party that I would walk into, see someone and not be able to go over to them.
Right.
Right? That right. would be a problem for me.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I guess that, that speaks to the greater point that, is at issue now. And that is, that we're so unbelievably divided right now.
Yeah.
And it's funny that quite literally at every election for the last 24 years, I have said, the exact same things. Like, God, I never thought that we could be so polarized. And
right down the middle.
Right.
Like, look at the Bush Gore, right? What was it at the end of the night? It came down to Florida and there was like double-digit difference. I mean, that's insane.
Exactly. But we're 100 times more divided now. I mean—
Oh, yeah. No,
it's not that the change in that razor cut is the same. It's that the sides have gotten farther and farther and farther apart progressively.
And the antipathy is off the charts.
Exactly. Yeah. And, and so the far left is just as bad as the far right. I mean, it's insane. I mean, I was fascinated by Bernie Sanders, but at the same time, I was terrified by a 90% tax rate or, whatever it was that we were, that he was talking about.
Right.
I think that's not realistic. And what I don't understand is that, like, the farther and farther apart these two sides get, I mean, nature abhors a vacuum. Like, at what point does that enormous canyon between the two of us just suck something into the center of it?
Well, I think it feels so, it's so murky because in our lifetimes, it's never been as bad as it is now. So we don't have a frame of reference.
Well, what's hard for me is to look at, sort of where we are now and, what has happened in the last 18 months. And, majority of the energy, has been focused on undoing things that were done in the last 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when we look at what happened in the last 8 years as far as the economy and prosperity goes— I mean, we're on a good trajectory. So why, if we were on a good trajectory, do we want to go and undo things that were contributing mm-hmm. to that success?
Mm-hmm.
If it's not just just purely mercenary
mm-hmm.
ego
mm-hmm.
at work.
Drastically changing gears. Well, tell me how does all this manifest itself in your restaurants? You talked about how many people you employ. You talked about, some of this is about looking out for them.
It doesn't really. I definitely feel that. In the community, I live in a very conservative place,
sure.
But it's extraordinarily liberal, for the state that we're situated in. I mean, Oxford is a liberal bastion, in a very red state,
mm-hmm.
but it still votes. I mean, Oxford still votes red.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens to be a little more blue. It's, we're sort of purple.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is, in the community, there's a certain amount of consternation.
You mean towards you?
Yes. I don't think that people have, you know, have ever really known what to make of me exactly. You know, we, from the very first moment we went into business, like one of the, you know, one of our, you know, most important things in my mind that we dedicated ourselves to was being, you know, good stewards of, you know, of good work within our community. Mm-hmm. That if, you know, we had a, you know, I just felt like, and this is nothing that I was ever taught or, you know, came through business ethics or, you know, that we have a responsibility to give something back to our community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if otherwise you're Robert Barons, if you just take, mm-hmm. You're not nurturing the health of your community. And so we've always been active in nonprofit work in our community. But other than that, I didn't participate in a lot. People didn't get to know me. I buried myself in the kitchen. And so I didn't have much of a social life outside of the people that I worked with,
mm-hmm.
or our guests to a certain degree. And in 1992, I won't say that restaurant work was ignoble, but it's not a noble profession. It's a service mm-hmm. profession. And, you know, so they're not, I think with there being some, you know, sort of old money and established guard and Oxford, like there wasn't a, you know, a fascination with getting the new world-traveled chef, you know, into their homes to, you know, dazzle them with conversation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've always sort of stayed on the fringe. And it's not to say that I don't have very wonderful friends in Oxford. I do. I mean, mm-hmm. some of the best friendships and most important friendships I've made in my entire life are there. And I love the place deeply. But I live a very, you know, sort of odd life. And I think that this has certainly contributed to that. You know, at the same time, I don't know that the guys that I work with every day know exactly what to make of me either. I mean, I don't think that they look at me as their champion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that, you know, that I have, you know, I do have some friends as a result of the work that I've done in, you know, fighting for LGBT rights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's, I'm not the, you know, I'm not sort of held up as, you know, as somebody who is, you know, is, I don't have people running up to me daily going, thank you, you know, for what you do. You know, people just sort of cock their head and, you know, and look at me like a puppy going to the vet the first time.
This is a total gear shift, but can you just speak to a little about your path to the kitchen? Because I find it to be a fascinating one. It was, you didn't strictly grow up in the South.
Not strictly. I mean, I was born and raised in New Orleans, and then I'd spent summers with my parents were genius. They figured out a way that my our grandparents lived in Georgia and North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
and my mom was a school teacher. And we'd get out of school, we'd go to the beach for a couple of weeks, and we'd leave the beach, and my mother would immediately take my brother and I to Georgia,
mm-hmm.
drop one of us off, and then go on to North Carolina and drop the other one off and visit with her parents. And then she would go off, and for 6 weeks in the summertime, my brother and I would spend 3 weeks with our grandparents, and we'd meet somewhere in the middle, and our grandparents would swap us over, and then we'd go spend 3 weeks
hand off.
The other. Right. And then my mom would come back and pick us up, and it'd be time to go back to school. So she and my dad, you know, had for, you know, the better part of a decade, you know, summers to themselves. And, you know, which I think speaks to partially to, you know, why, you know, they remained together and, you know, until my mother passed.
Mm-hmm.
But so my grandparents in North Carolina, they were sustenance farmers. I mean, they kept a gigantic home garden for themselves.
That's what you mean by sustenance farmers? They farm for themselves?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they, and so.
Was it both vegetable, was it livestock as well?
No, my people were pig farmers. So mm-hmm. there was pig farming going on, but not at my grandparents' house.
Right.
And so we kid about the fact that, you know, our summers up there, were like indentured servitude, because like going to visit the grandparents meant getting up at the crack of dawn and going down the hill to the garden and picking tomatoes and picking cucumbers and okra and beans and peas and, you know, hauling them all back up the hill. And then we'd, you know, I remember sort of so vividly that when it was hot, you know, my grandmother would do the sheets every morning, and she'd bring the sheets out and hang them on the clothesline. And I remember, you know, sort of sitting on a basket between those wet sheets, and the breeze would blow through, and because they were wet, it was cool. And so shucking corn and you know, and shelling peas, sort of sitting in the sheets. It's very romantic. So
when you say indentured servitude, that indicates that you weren't into it. Were you not into it?
Well, no. I mean, I just tease about, you know, you know, where the sort of country club set that I grew up with in New Orleans, you know, spent time around the pool at the tennis club in the summers, you know, that, you know, we went off and shelled peas, you know. And, you know, the odd thing was that I loved it.
You did?
Oh, yeah. My grandfather was a tinkerer, and so both of them were tinkerers. And so, you know, it's how I learned small engine repair and, you know, how to handle power tools and whatnot was through hanging out with those guys.
Farmers are tinkerers?
Both. I mean, both.
No, but I'm saying farmers are.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
if there's extra pieces around, if there's, they will find a way, they'll make a contraption, they will. That's a very common trait, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Things don't go to waste.
Right. Yeah. Well, and you got to keep your stuff running. I mean, like, you know, it was one of the things that, you know, two or three times, you know, while I was up there, you know, my grandfather would be working on the plow. I had to get this little handheld plow up and running again.
Right.
You know, there was that. I lived in New Orleans where, you know, food is a birthright. And it was, you know, it was an interesting time to grow up in New Orleans because sort of unbeknownst to me, I didn't really understand it. New Orleans was a city that had this extensive food culture to it. That, you know, the long and short of it was that you know, it was based, you know, it's arguably the, you know, the first sort of fusion cuisine. You know, you had African and Caribbean cooks that were trying to recreate the food of France and Spain with local ingredients. And so you know, that's where, you know, Creole French came from. The restaurants that I grew up going to as a youngster, you know, they were transitioning from cooking with integrity to not really trusting their customer base anymore. New Orleans becoming, you know, a real sort of tourist destination and catering to the sort of dumbed down, you know, whims of what they thought that their customers wanted.
This would be the culinary equivalent of the term. A friend of mine from Arab, Alabama, taught me a great phrase, putting on the hee-haw. Do you know that term?
No, but I love it. And I know exactly.
His example of the foremost offender on this front is Paula Deen. But he said, who I don't know personally, but he is a Southerner. The term means really playing up the accent and really going to town, usually for the benefit of somebody not of the South,
right,
to cash in on or perpetuate a certain mythical Southern figure.
And typically a cartoonish one.
Cartoonish would be another word for it, right. Yes. So this would be the culinary equivalent of putting on the hee-haw.
To a certain degree. You know, I think they just, you know, they went from, you know, very classical French preparation of food to, you know, sort of dumbing down technique, dumbing down the quality of ingredients that they were using.
Was there a homogenization of menus that came along with that?
I think that there certainly was. And as a result, you know, you ended up sort of running up against the time of Susan Spicer and Emeril entering the scene, Frank Brightson, you know, who were all brilliant cooks, but were the first ones to go, okay, let's rethink this a little bit. Let's really look at the history of this place, and, you know, let's recapture.
Yeah.
And so they begin walking it back, and the next generation of guys like Donald Link and John Besh come along and completely kick it to, you know, another level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what the, you know, sort of the greater glory of the aftermath of Katrina is the food renaissance that's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a very young generation of chefs that have come in and really embraced the history of New Orleans, have explored the food. And, you know, and so now, you know, you have guys out there, you know, like Nina Compton,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, although she's not a New Orleanian, you know, was immediately able to, you know, embrace the Caribbean sort of ingredient of the food of New Orleans and fill a space that didn't exist before.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she makes this food that is beautiful, it's thoughtful, and is a very obvious piece,
yeah.
you know, of what contributed to, you know, the food of the city of New Orleans. And, you know, and they're continuing. I mean, and you've got, you know, guys like Tori McPhail at Commander's, you know, who was, you know, came after Jamie Shannon, who was completely revered and was, you know, taking Commander's to yet another level that, you know, that Emerald had elevated it to.
Yep.
And Tori has continued to do the same thing as well. And so, you know, while you have so many of these restaurants in New Orleans, like Antoine's, that, you know, have just flailed, and, you know, and all they're trying to do is like continuing to shovel out, you know, a version of Oysters Rockefeller,
mm-hmm.
You know, to keep the tourists happy and, you know, sort of keep the older guard, you know, placated in New Orleans. It'll continue to go there. You know, you have Commander's at 125 years that's not done evolving. You know, it's they're not going to give up and become irrelevant.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they make moves like trusting Tori McPhail. Tori was 27 or 28 years old when he was given the reins at Commander's. And this,
crazy.
You know, you're talking about a $12, $14 million a year, you know, business that you're putting a 28-year-old in front of. And, you know, Tori's completely deserving of it. But, you know, you have a hard time visualizing that, you know, unless – you know, you have the brains of a T. Martin and Lally Brennan, Ella Brennan, you know, out there to say, you know, this is the way that we continue, you know, to roll forward.
You have to have amazing confidence in your instincts as a spotter of talent.
Well, and to understand that, you know, you have to dig younger all the time if you want to remain relevant.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise you just age out.
Right. Yeah, you become a classic for a number, can be a good number of years, but then eventually you're hopelessly behind the times.
Yeah, you're the rock star that's, you know, that goes from playing arenas to playing casino ballrooms,
right.
You know, to VA halls, and then to, you know, just begging anybody, you know, putting out a sex tape at 80.
You just rattled off a little update on New Orleans. Forgive me for phrasing this in what I'm sure is a dopey wave from a guy who lives in New York, but you're part of the Southern Foodways Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
What is the relationship like amongst chefs of the major Southern cities? There really seems to be a camaraderie there. There seems to be a real awareness there. There seems to be sort of a mutual, you know, rooting for each other sort of vibe that I get whenever I sit down with somebody. Am I correct in all of that? And how does it perpetuate itself?
Well, I mean, a number of things. I mean, I've been involved in the SFA since its inception,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, this is our 20th symposium in the fall.
Wow.
And, you know, and it's interesting because that's, you know, also not far off of the, you know, time when, you know, I began coming to the Beard Awards.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, instinctively, it was Ann Cashin from Cashin's Eat Place in D.C.,
mm-hmm.
who's originally from Jackson, Mississippi, and John T. About the time that I started coming. And I think it was about the time that John T. started coming and, you know, Ann had been recognized by the foundation. But
this is John T. Edge.
John T. Edge, yes. Those two guys, on the very first year that I went up, said, you know, we should have lunch together. I mean, the awards don't go off until the evening. There's really nothing to do on Monday. They have a big party on Sunday night, but we should have lunch.
Yeah.
And so we went to a little Spanish restaurant down just north of Soho. There was a chef named Cesare, and I cannot remember the name of the place. But we had a lunch, and I remember that it was there were six of us at this lunch. And we had a good time doing it. And so the second year, we went back, and you know there were about 12 or 15 people. And we ended up moving to Butter down when it was down on Lafayette.
Yeah.
And Alex, it grew, I mean, enough to the point we needed a place of our own. And Alex wasn't open at lunch, and she agreed to do the lunch for us. And she yearly put out this the most splendid spread. And
what was her connection to this group?
I do not remember how, how it was that we ended up there. And I think it was probably through Ann Cashin that she and Ann probably had a friendship. And Alex and I developed a really nice friendship. And I love her because there's, I had met her out at, I know what it was. We were all at Worlds of Flavor out at the CIA.
I just did that for the first time.
And,
in Napa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, oh, and I know Matt and Ted Lee's first book was edited by Nina Gornishelli.
Yeah, yeah.
Her mom.
Yeah.
So Alex and I developed this nice relationship because I think like she embodies like everything about a curmudgeonly New Yorker, you know, that exists. But at the same time, she's like this gooey, lovey center to her. And so we had this wonderful friendship. And as we were leaving the restaurant at the end of lunch one year, early on, she grabbed me. She's like, "Curtis, I need to talk to you for a second." And I said, "Well, what about it, love?" And she goes, "What is wrong with you people?" And I said, "What do you mean?" She goes, "There's no way that you get this many people in this industry in a room together and you all act like you like each other. Like, what the hell is wrong with you people? Like, I don't trust you."
That's such a New Yorker comment.
And
it's hilarious.
And you know, and I think, you know, the thing about it is it you know, to us, you know, the industry is it's about community. I mean, the table, you know, is about where we gather to eat and share with one another.
Right.
And, you know, so, you know, I love the fact that, you know, the first time that I tasted Mike Latta's chicken liver pate, that, you know, I asked him, I was like, "What is the secret? Where is the crossroads where you made your deal with the devil on this?" And he goes, it's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
And he literally walks me through it. And he goes, "I'm going to make some this afternoon. If you want to come back over, you know, come on and, you know, and I'll walk you through it with me." That we just, you know, we don't have secrets.
Is this a natural thing that you think grows out of the culture of the region? Or is this some, is this a response in some way? I grew up geographically in the South, but I think of it as South adjacent. I grew up in Florida. In Coral Gables, Florida, which isn't really the South, really.
I have for years have been trying to, you know, sort of drag Florida into the fold, you know, by Michelle Bernstein's hair.
Oh, like, I love Michelle. Know, right? I wrote Michelle's book with her.
Such a great human being.
But I was very aware of, so I've always been comfortable in the South. My family was in the garment business. They had a showroom in Tennessee or a plant in Tennessee. So I spent time there. But I am aware that there is a feeling very often of a snobism coming from the Northeast to the South, from the West Coast toward the South. Is this community feeling that you're describing a reaction in some parts to that, or is it completely separate from that and nothing to do with that?
I mean, I think it's a combination of things. I mean, you know, I think no matter, you know, how far we are removed historically from the, you know, the sort of uglier, you know, time, you know, in the South that existed. I mean, it is a very troubled place.
Yeah.
That there, you know, is sort of this feeling, you know, that's not discussed a lot, that, you know, we are sort of all in this thing together. And it really, you know, oddly is sort of been us against the rest of the world. And that, you know, that there has been this, you know, sort of intellectual elitism that, you mm-hmm. know, I remember like literally the first time that, you know, 20 years ago went up to vacation in Maine.
Yeah.
And going, well, we're going to fly into Boston and rent a car. And like, I had this thing, you know, this ethnocentric curiosity, like, are we getting ready to sort of launch ourselves into, you know, Harvard Square? And like, that's where, like, that our vacation is going to be very intellectual. Right. And as we drove into Maine, like, there's more NASCAR beer signs. And I was like, oh, there's rednecks everywhere. Like, I love this. It's, you know, it's perfect. And so there's.
There definitely are.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and yeah, I mean, the South is, you know, has made it, you know, very easy,
yeah.
You know, to be picked on, you know, I think from time to time. You know, but the ironic thing is that, you know, you think in terms of, you know, sort of like the New York Times, just sort of the driving, you know, or the New Yorker, you know, sort of these driving pieces of literature, you know, or journalism that, you know, that are out there and help perpetuate this.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look historically at, you know, who's on the masthead, you know, they're either one populated by a significant number of Southerners, you know, or very much aspiring Southerners. Like, mm-hmm. I never have known anybody in my life who went to the grave dying to actually be from the South than Johnny Appel. You know, one of the original boys on the bus, you know, mm-hmm. one of the smartest people that you ever mm-hmm. could have had the chance to have conversation with, he wanted to be from the South worse than anybody.
That's so funny.
In the history
that definitely,
of the world.
If you read his stuff, that does come through.
Well, and his wife was as genteel a Southerner as possible. And, you know, and Johnny spent a lot of time in the South, you know, in its most troubled times,
mm-hmm.
covering, you know, the civil rights movement. But I think understood it, and oddly, in sort of the same way that Tony did, you know, when he came to Mississippi to mm-hmm. do our episode together, that he'd completely misjudged everything about it,
mm-hmm.
and had allowed a, you know, sort of a New York filter to provide him with the information mm-hmm. that he based his preconception on.
Yeah.
But after being there, had to completely rethink it. So it's a very natural part of who we are.
Yeah.
But, you know, more than anything else, like there's nothing that I revel in, you know, more than the admiration of accomplishments of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that, you know, things like the Beard Awards specifically, you know, tend to, you know, create more competition and more divide,
mm-hmm.
You know, than they do camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and as a result, you know, I continue to return annually, you know, to the Beard Awards. As I, you know, I tell
well,
people,
you've won a Beard Award.
Yeah, 2009, which, you know, I think I tell people all the time, I think was actually the recession year for the awards. You know, it was either like, let's get rid of Currents and get him out of this equation and just get on with
them. Come on. It is interesting what you say about not just the Beard Awards, but all awards to me. There is an entire population. People outside the industry don't perceive this at all, but there is an entire population of chefs who are right under the layer of people who get those awards. And I don't just mean the Bureau. I mean all these awards who feel like the deck is stacked. You know, if you have a smaller restaurant, if you can't afford a publicist, if you can't afford to take the time to travel around and be promoting yourself or disappear for a period of time and be on a television show, there is a level of attention you cannot get if you are someone who's just, you know, literally going week to week in your restaurant and hanging on,
right,
as a lot of people are. And again, civilians don't get this, but I think this applies to a lot of very well-reviewed places that the average person would see these places from afar and think, those guys are living the life. Those people are on top of the world. And a lot of times they're not. The margins in your business are slim. I mean, they're really slim. And there are restaurants that people think are doing great that, you know, are barely hanging on.
For a decade and a half, I wanted to keep a, you know, a monthly financial statement in my pocket for, you know, the number of times that I would, you know, I'd get somebody that, you know, came to town on a football weekend and kind of slap me on the back, go, man, where you keep that printing press? You just printing money back there, aren't you? Well, it's actually all that glitters is not gold.
Right.
You know, it's, it is a struggle. And, you know, what, you know, I don't mean to speak, you know, poorly of the, you know, of the foundation and, you know, and what they're doing currently. You know, I love this sort of chef's boot camp, you know, that they've put together. And, you know, but the unfortunate reality is that, you know, you do have a lot of people out there that, you know, that perform daily, you know, with that metal in mind. And, you know, and I continue to go back and, you know, and have to have these sort of chalk talks with, you know, with a couple of guys that, you know, they got to take their eye off the prize. Like if that's your motivation,
if that's
every
the prize,
day.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, if you ultimately get it because that's been your motivation, then it's ill-gotten gain. You know, I had somebody who called me, you know, after, you know, I received the award to, you know, to sort of ask me like, well, you know, how much do you think that your publicist really helped, you know, with you getting the Beard Award? And I said, look, I didn't have a publicist before
right.
we won the Beard Award
right.
because I didn't know what they did.
Yeah.
And the reason that I hired a publicist was because I knew that, you know, winning that award was, you know, I had about a year-long window of opportunity
right.
that I was a guy that had won in that year. And I wanted to take as much advantage of it
yeah.
as possible
yeah.
and grow our brand.
You had political clout.
Sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so I did. But it's funny that Ben Barker, who was he and his wife, Ben and Karen, that had Magnolia Grill in Durham, you know, I remember – you know, a decade and a half ago, Ben going, worst thing you do is win this damn thing. Because like once you've won it, then they just forget about you. Like you sort of begin
yeah.
your journey into obscurity.
Unless you're Wolfgang Puck, who I think is the only chef who won it twice, the Outstanding Chef Award.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, second time was a tie.
Okay.
10 years after the first, he tied with Jean-Georges.
Wow.
But I don't. There's not no other chef who's done that. But
yeah.
yes, you. That is sort of your. It's like a life. It becomes like a lifetime achievement award for some people.
You know, I'm a little, you know, confounded at times because I worry, you know, whether, you know, what people's motivations, you know, are as far as, you know, doing what they're doing. But
mm-hmm.
I think that there's no question about it. Like that shines through in the quality of service and the quality of food and beverage that, you know, exist in that place.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you go to 11 Madison Park and, you know, if you're fortunate enough to be able to do that, you know exactly what Daniel and Will are made of.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, you know, and I remember feeling the exact same way the first time that I went into Noodle Bar, sort of
mm-hmm.
a couple of months after it opened and going, all right, I got to know this guy.
Yeah.
It's like you can literally taste their soul through
mm-hmm.
their food.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the genuine, you know, the genuine nature of it. Food is a, you know, a narrative.
Yeah.
You know, we're telling stories through food. And this, you know, is probably sounds like hyper-intellectualized to most people. But, you know, it's why, you know, writing the first book all of a sudden became very easy for me, because when I realized it, as I was writing these head notes, it's like every recipe that I'm writing has a story attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thread to a piece of my life. I mean,
mm-hmm.
every plate that I'm taking to the table that I have for all these years that I really didn't understand what I was doing is sharing a piece of my life
mm-hmm.
with people. And, you know, that is extraordinarily satisfying to me. That's what I love about what I do. And, you know, to go back to, you know, the South, you know, we're incredible storytellers.
Mm.
You know, it's a hallmark. Songwriters, storytellers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, we're right in the, you know, in the heart of the breadbasket.
Well,
of
you are operating in Faulknerville.
Precisely.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. You know, I'll pray to ever be a fraction as complex as the man was.
Well, I don't know that food needs – I don't – that might be taking it too far with food.
Yeah. It's early Sean Brock. But But yeah, I mean, you know, I think that's the, you know, ultimately the thing that is that's misunderstood about the South, that while, you know, people have scratched their heads about us, it was really Craig Claiborne, you know, sort of going down to the Triangle. And what my theory is that it was when Edna Lewis was in residence at Farrington, mm-hmm. In the early 80s, that she and Claiborne had a very close friendship.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced that it was that he went down to visit her, or went down sort of at her behest to say, you know, see what was happening down there, because these restaurants were beginning to happen. Mm-hmm. And he came back and he did two lengthy features, one on the Triangle itself and then another on Bill Neal. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was basically lighting the torch that said, hey, we might need to pay attention to what's going on down here. There's some smart stuff. And, you know, as that rolls forward and, you know, that generation of chefs that oddly includes Frank Stitt, this is what I absolutely adore. Like, people talk about Bill Neal sort of being at that genesis point of the understanding, you know, of the significance of Southern food. Frank was doing the exact same thing at the exact same time. It just happened to be way off the path in Birmingham, Alabama. And so, mm-hmm. you know, nationally it wasn't being paid attention to, but it was happening at the exact same time that that Bill was being celebrated. But
can you just quickly tell people who Bill Neal was?
You know, as this always goes, I get completely off track. But my first job was actually cooking on a tugboat.
On the tugboat?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. That was the summer after I graduated from high school. And I just, you know, I fell in love with it. Mm-hmm. And so I picked up, you know, jobs while I was, you know, in college, sort of here and there in order to make some pocket money. But I fell into Crook's Corner in about 1986.
This is Bill Neal's restaurant.
Yes, sir.
Yep.
Crook's was, you know, at the time, I just had a bunch of friends that were working there. I didn't realize the sort of significance of what was happening there.
Yeah.
And so I got a job as a dishwasher. Well, actually, I got a job as a busboy, and I was dismissed for lacking the social graces that they needed or wanted in their dining room.
Okay.
But I was immediately rehired as a dishwasher. And this is like, I think they seemed to feel like I had, you know,
Let's get him in the back of the house.
Right. That, the temperament for a
right.
For
let's the hide kitchen. This guy. Right.
And so Bill noticed that, like, I couldn't sit still. So I was washing dishes during the day when there wasn't service.
Yeah.
And so I was just basically sort of waiting for, you know, things to get dirtied and, you know, and sort of clean the bathrooms and whatnot. And I would just instinctively, like, jump in and help the prep cooks because I wanted something to do. And he saw this in me, and he took me under his wing and began sort of training me as his protege.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bill was not spending all of his time in the kitchen at this point. He was very much sort of into the front of the house as well, and working with his wine list. But we worked side by side for about 2.5 years, and it was a tremendous experience because Bill was extraordinarily passionate about his craft. About his ingredients. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were, you know, we had farmers that actually came by the restaurant, you know, every day. We had a guy who drove up from the coast that delivered our shrimp twice a week for shrimp and grits. And so, you know, I remember, you know, these moments like, you know, arugula coming into the kitchen, which, you know, at that time, it's like I had heard of it. And he said, "You've never heard of rocket greens?" "Oh, I grew up with these things. I used to grow wild in our yard." He's like, "You have to taste this." And, you know, watching, you know, the joy in his eyes as, like, he saw me respond to this peppery bite of the first piece of arugula that I ever put in my mouth. And so Bill was an enormous influence. And it was there that I really fell in love with cooking.
Yeah.
I won't say for a second that, you know, at 23 that I was ready to dedicate my life to it. It wasn't until, you know, I was coaxed into moving back to New Orleans to help a friend open Gautreaux's in 89, that, you know, I went to work in New Orleans, and then you know, we went from second gear into fifth gear, mm-hmm. just like that, as far as my love for it went. Bill is someone who, he was taken from us, too early. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the sad thing is, I think Bill was in, his late 30s or early 40s. He died in 1992, and his partner in Crooks, the night of our award, of the Beard Awards in 2009, Gene Hamer is his name. Gene was at the awards, and Gene is a man of so few words. It's almost terminal.
Mm-hmm.
Gene came and gave me the biggest hug in the world, and he goes, you know, I hope you know that somewhere Bill's very proud of you right now.
Oh, my God.
And I mean, I was reduced to just a blubbering mess.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, yeah, Bill. Bill is a wonderful figure, and you know, and he is sort of largely credited, you know, for, you know, being there at that point of when, you know, I think, you know, the media of the North really began to take a very true look, mm-hmm. At the food of the South, mm-hmm. and you know. You then begin to see that, you know, the understanding of the history of that food unfolding. And, you know, we're now at a point where, you know, I think most folks can see that, you know, that Southern food,
yeah.
which is almost undefinable now, that, you know, folks do understand it's not all, you know, the soul food, mm-hmm. and the fried donut, mm-hmm. cheeseburger of Paula Deen, but that it is, you know, dozens of different immigrant populations, right. that have folded themselves in, you know, to this beautiful tapestry,
yep.
that tells a story of the history of the South. You can literally see the history of the South through the food that we eat in these different little pockets. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a penny bright, landing on all four feet.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods. Heritage Foods was founded to sell ancient breeds of livestock and poultry that were becoming extinct, largely because industrial agriculture willfully pushed healthy heritage breeds aside for more profitable, faster-growing animals. Rare heritage breeds are saved when popular demand increases and farmers have the incentive to raise them. This Thanksgiving, we encourage you to buy a turkey from Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. Frank's turkeys are 100% purebred heritage, 100% pasture-raised, and 100% antibiotic-free. Turkeys are available in 2-pound increments. You choose your size. Don't wait. Pre-order your Heritage Thanksgiving turkey today at heritagefoods.com.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to get you right back to my interview with Chef John Currents. Just a quick reminder, if you'd like to follow the show, the easiest way to do that is to subscribe on Stitcher or iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you would like to follow us on social media, the best place to do that is on Instagram by the handle @ChefPodcast. That is @ChefPodcast. You're also welcome to follow me personally. My handle is @ToklandAndrew, TOQUELAND, Andrew. And now we'll get you right back to the rest of my interview with John Currents. I hope you enjoy it. You've talked about storytelling, tradition. You also talked about, you know, your own life coming into play, right? Mm-hmm. What is the sort of matrix of these things? Like, as you go about composing a new dish or thinking about a dish throughout your career, how do you take the reference points of the South and currentize them? Like, how do you negotiate that give and take?
Well,
does that question make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense. And I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with, you know, sort of where the food of the South has come from, and that, you know, and that is, you know, kind of a borrowing of ingredient or technique or dish from, you know, all sorts of different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I'm sort of wonderfully fascinated, you know, with, you know, one of the few misconceptions which continues to, you know, exist, you know, about our industry, you know, and that is that, you know, there really isn't anything that's that original anymore. I mean, once you get beyond Grant Achatz and, you know, and what's
and Ferran and yeah, Wiley,
yeah, that. Yeah. There's a finite number of ingredients mm-hmm. out there, and the combinations have, you know, have all been explored mm-hmm. and some, you know, sort of overexplored. And so, you know, we are sort of ultimately, you know, borrowing inspiration from one place or another. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've been very fortunate that, you know, that I have had the opportunity to travel and live, you know, on, you know, sort of all points on the planet. But, you know, a majority of, you know, of what my, you know, life's creativity has been around is, you know, tasting things in one place or another mm-hmm. and going, wow, I like that. This is how I would do this mm-hmm. with crawfish instead of lobster. It's funny that when I opened City Grocery in 92, I had no business opening a restaurant. Mm-hmm. I was 27 years mm-hmm. old. You know, I'd been in the business for a while, but I didn't have any idea for what it was supposed to be. I didn't have enough experience, you know, to open a place that, you know, had a theme to it. You know, I didn't know enough about French. I knew a little bit about a lot of things. And so what I convinced myself would be clever was that if, you know, our narrative would be that we're going to open the restaurant, you can put a label on it. How about that? I cook whatever I want to mm-hmm. every day when I go in. Mm-hmm. And what I want to do is create a menu where no matter who came through the door, everybody could find something mm-hmm. that would turn them on. And so that wouldn't be that place where it was like the sort of New Orleans French restaurant in Oxford, Mississippi. You just couldn't describe it. But what I found out very quickly was that when you don't have an elevator pitch, mm-hmm. and Frank Stitt was the first person that asked me, doing a dinner one time. I said, John, I've heard that your restaurant is lovely. Tell me what about your philosophy on food? It's like I was 27 years old. Like I didn't know philosophy entered into this conversation. I try to cook good food. I don't know what you mean. And I was crushed.
Do you have a philosophy now?
I think that I have a better idea. But it took a trip to work in France for about 3 or 4 weeks. And
at what point in your career?
98.
Okay.
It was my dad's 60th birthday. But I mean, before I go over there, I mean, I'll say, you know, you look at guys like Michael Solomonov, mm-hmm. who's one of my favorite people in the world. And, you know, he lives and breathes Israeli food.
Yeah.
You know, now, oddly, after having been to Israel with him, you know, to understand that there is no, like, I mean, the beautiful thing about Israeli food is it's very similar to the food in New Orleans in that, you know, it's all of this patchwork of all these different immigrant populations that descended on Israel that have made up that food.
Yeah.
You know, it takes part, you know, from, you know, the indigenous foods of the area, but it you know, the fact that, you know, this is what I absolutely love, like the irony of going to a falafel shop in Israel, almost every one of them serves falafel and they serve schnitzel. Mm. And I'm like, I would think that like maybe that would be just sort of grotesquely inappropriate at serving schnitzel, you know, in an Israeli restaurant.
Right.
But there are so many German Jews that migrated to Israel at the time, right?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think, you know, going to France in 98, I was raising a garden every year and I was over there in the summer and I found myself for the first time traveling abroad where my first craving was not for a cheeseburger, you know, or for a pizza, you know, that just sort of like grossly thinking about it, like, God, I can't wait to eat a cheeseburger when I get home.
When I get home, yeah.
But I knew that all these things were growing in my garden and that like all I wanted was, you know, like sautéed squash with lemon and stewed okra and tomatoes and green beans and corn and like all these things were just sitting there on the vine, you know, or on the plant, you know, for me when I got home. And I was dreaming about them and dreaming about them and dreaming about them and realized that no matter how much I had, you know, spent time in the kitchen with Bill Neal and what I should have learned from him, that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, I understood that I'd been pushing aside this food that came from my grandmother's Sunday supper table. And sort of sublimating that as, you know, just sort of like, that's, you know, Sunday supper food. Like, and that was what Bill built his reputation on, was taking that food, you know, from, you know, the sideboards of his childhood and bringing him to the white linen. And it took me, on one of my last days there being,
Your last days overseas?
In France.
Yeah.
We were at the, there's this beautiful outdoor market in Cannes, that, we would go shop at every day.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, and oddly enough, the chef that I was working with, his name was Fred, Frenchman named Fred, comes running up to me with this tiny little pot of okra, and he says, "Chef, tell me about this. I see all the time at the market, and I do not know how to cook. Do you ever cook with this?" And I said, "Boy, do I!"
Yeah.
I said, "Go get some okra, and we'll go back to the house, and that's what we'll cook tonight. We'll cook okra five or six different ways," and. So he goes away and he comes back and he has this tiny little bag with like six or eight okra in it. Mm-hmm. And I realized all of a sudden what he was thinking. I was like, "No, dude, they're not hot. Go get all of them." And so
he thought it was like a chili.
Yeah.
So
we took it back and, you know, and I made my grandmother's black pepper boiled okra. We made stewed okra and tomatoes. We made quick okra pickles, some fried okra. Did a green gumbo with okra, and, you know, and as I cooked through all this, you know, with him, and he started tasting it, like I saw this, you know, light inside of him begin to light up, and I could see like he was immediately beginning to think like, how can I use this new weapon in what I cook, and, you know, in my war over my friends to make better food, and like all of a sudden I have this magical thing, you know, that's that's wonderful. And
but this, you said the light went off in him, but this, but to you also, you, to go back to the storytelling analogy you made, you were telling him your story in a sensory way.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and also, you know, and this is, you know, we have this, I love this wonderfully sort of tempestuous relationship, you know, in our minds and hearts, you know, with French chefs or French chefs with us, where like we don't deserve to cook soup for their dogs. You know, historically, so that all of a sudden I've got a French chef who's not only impressed but excited, you know, about something. And we had a wonderful time working together. He's a tremendous guy and a great chef. But I was like, and it really made me realize all of a sudden, I was like, I've sublimated all this stuff. Like, why have I never served stewed okra and tomatoes in the restaurant? It's like, it doesn't make any sense. And so that part of sort of Southern food, the foods that my mother made at home, you know, began immediately to become part of the food at City Grocery.
What was your relationship to that food? And the reason I ask that is, I don't know if you ever heard, do you ever hear the story of the first time Paul Prudhomme went on the Today Show? I think he made a gumbo. His brother, one of his brothers, he had a big family, was furious that he went on national television and cooked what he called the trash food of the poor.
Okay.
They were ashamed of it.
Right.
Right? What was your relationship to that kind of home cooking? Did it seem like going into a restaurant, did it feel, until you had that epiphany, did it feel beneath that? Like, did it feel beneath what you would serve in a restaurant?
Well,
or was it just such separate worlds you just didn't think about it?
There were worlds, you know, that just didn't overlap.
Right.
You know, and this is why, you know, I freely admit how stupid I was, because, you know, 6 years prior, I had started working for Bill Neal, or 7 or 8 years prior, I'd started working for Bill Neal, and this is exactly what he was doing in his restaurant that had gotten him, you know, the attention of the New York Times. But, you know, I think as a young chef, you know, or, you know, young whatever you are, Because you're not a chef until you understand what it is that that's really the last step in becoming a chef, is when you really understand what it is that you're trying to express to people through your food. That, you know, as a young cook, you know, sort of beginning the journey to becoming a chef, you feel like, you know, you have to create things that, you know, that people have never had before. And, you know, and so, you know, people end up putting together awful combination of things like uni and foie gras and, you know, things that shouldn't be on the same plate, but they think that they can shock people into being impressed. You know, so you feel this obligation in some way, shape or form to invent the next Caesar salad.
Right.
You know, but because the classics exist, you know, it means inventing the new classic more often than not. You know, it means frying a Twinkie or, you know, combining things that shouldn't be on the same plate. You know, instead of going, okay, well, why don't we dissect the Caesar salad and look at it and see what makes it amazing and then improve on it. Until you're cooking from that part deepest inside of you where your passion is most solidly rooted, that what you're doing is, you know, is disingenuous. I mean, it's you're not performing at your absolute level. And you know, the interesting thing about it is that, you know, that was the moment where cooking became very easy for me. You know, because I was cooking these things that I loved, that I was sharing with people, you know, because I loved them and was sharing a part of my story with them.
Right.
And trying to carry them to, you know, that place in my life that, you know, had brought me joy. And that's, I mean, it really is like that. That was like, I remember those moments.
You know, found your voice.
Found my voice and, you know, and really truly settled into a complete and total joy in the kitchen. I always loved doing it. You know, from the minute I started doing it.
Yeah.
Loved it deeply. But discovering the real joy of it came with, you know, finding my voice and understanding like what it was that, you know, that I wanted to express. And so, you know, it was that moment when I realized, like, now I can finally go back and talk to Frank and explain the answer to the question that he asked me 5 years ago.
Do you remember?
No. We've never been back to talk about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, that it's interesting. It's like really, you know, we don't talk about, you know, that step in the journey. You know, there's so much misconception about, you know, what it means to be a chef. Like there is nothing that, you know, I mean, you can get a diploma, but it doesn't mean diddly in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
You know, this is the significant part of, you know, of what it is we're, you know, that we're talking about. And ultimately, you know, everybody, you know, who really cares, who's really doing something significant is telling a story. Mm-hmm. I mean, Michael Solomonoff is telling a story.
Oh, my God.
You know,
sure.
Michael Anthony at Gramercy Tavern, you know, who I think is one of the greatest talents, you know, in the kitchen. You know, I don't know that you can, you know, come up with, you know, what his version of, you know, there's no ethnic story behind it.
No, but he uses the word story. I'm actually pretty friendly with Michael.
Yeah.
More than any chef I know.
Right.
He talks about the story of a dish.
Right.
Yeah.
And
he actually talks about the story of a service.
Okay.
You know, at the end of a night, what was the story of the night? Like, he loves that word.
There is a story there, you know, for everyone.
You talk about the story of a dish, right?
Mm-hmm.
What about the restaurants? Where do ideas come from for you for restaurants? Is it a similar place?
Well, my wife teases me that, you know, that whenever I get a particular craving, we, you know, open a
restaurant.
Store that, you know, feeds that craving. You know, I like to look at the landscape and just sort of try to examine, you know, what's missing.
Yeah.
You know, so I freely admit that I'm a, you know, sort of a jack of all trades, but a master of none. I'm a mimic at heart. And I mean, I love to do, you know, impersonations
of
people and,
Well, I mean, you can't just say that. We got a podcast here.
No, I didn't say I was any good at
chefs
it.
Chefs or celebrities or celebrity chefs?
It really sort of depends moment to moment.
You're not going to give me one?
I'm not a good performer. They just kind of have to happen.
Okay.
But you got Fred a minute ago.
That's true.
My wife says that really, you know, in sort of the over-intellectual way, she says, you know, that really comes through in your food. And I think like one of the nicer compliments that I've ever gotten in my life is when Mike and Ashley Christensen and Alon Chai and I were in Israel,
Mike Solomonov.
Correct. Uh-huh. We had to cook several times while we were there, but we did a big dinner early in the trip. And we were at in an area called Rosh Pina, mm-hmm. Which houses what they sort of lovingly refer to as the Blackberry Farm of Israel. So it's this working farm, and they make their cheese and they raise sheep. And so we cooked this dinner, and you know the challenging thing about it was that you know they toured us around the farm, and they were so excited about showing us the farm like this. Tour went on all day long until it was finally about 4 o'clock, and we'd gone through and like harvested our ingredients from the farm and picked our cheeses and you know picked which sheep they were going to kill and what have you, and you know then all of a sudden it's 4 o'clock and we're shoved in the kitchen. We've got dinner service at 6:30 for you know 85 or 100 people, and we've each got to come up with you know a dish or two, and we're in the kitchen and everything is in Hebrew, which. I don't read or speak at all, right? And so, you know, spice boxes that were literally, and there were stacked spice boxes. And so there was probably 30 of them. And so every time I needed to find, you know, a spice, I'm like, I'm having to go through these boxes and smell, you know, first things that I don't know, things that are familiar, things that my mind's tricking me about, you know, that like, is this cinnamon or cumin?
Right.
But, you know, I remember I did an eggplant dish. And I remember Mike coming over, Solomonov coming over and going, it's like you've been cooking this food your whole life. And I literally almost balled up and cried. I was like, that's one of the nicest things that anybody could say to me. And so, I find my way, you know, through food in, you know, mimicking things that I, you know, that I've absolutely loved when I've tasted them. And
there is such a thing as food fluency, right? I mean, that's the term I use.
I think absolutely.
If that's your medium, you can almost speak it.
Sure.
You can create in that medium in a way that's not necessarily connected to a linear thought process. You can just, it's like someone who can play by ear.
Correct.
Right?
Right. I mean, I think absolutely.
Yeah. And that's a gift.
It is, and it's the gift that I think has carried me more than probably anything else.
You know, if there's a theme to this conversation, you know, is, you know, if you're a young cook, right, it's work, work, work. I mean, you work really hard.
Right.
You work really hard on technique. You put in long hours. You want to show you're the hardest worker in the kitchen because that's often how advancement happens. But I think creatively, what if I'm understanding everything you've been saying to me, there is such a thing as trying too hard.
Sure.
There is such a thing as over-examining what you're doing. You know, you ended up coming back to the thing that was right in front of you, you know, the whole time. I think that's really interesting. I think that's true for a lot of people. It reminds me of there's a great tennis writer. I also write about tennis a little. His name is Pete Bodo. And I was agonizing over a book project once. And he said to me, Andrew, just tell the freaking story.
Right.
You know, stop getting hung up on structure, on this, on that. That's just, you're getting in your own way. Just tell the story. If it's a good story, you'll be fine.
And that's it. I mean.
Which sounds like nothing in hindsight, but I really needed almost like that one person intervention.
Yeah.
Because I was like trying to contort this thing into something that would be fascinating when I was sitting on a good story.
Yeah. And I think John T. Edge, you know, said, you know, one of the, and again, this is back to like what we're talking about with my growing up with religion, with, you know, people saying, you know, things that, you know, are easy for them to say, you know, like you have all the right answers, you're asking the wrong questions, you know, that almost sound cliche, you know, but it's, you know, with writing, you know, I'm sure you heard it too. It's like The book, once you find your voice, the book will just write itself. Yeah. It'll just write itself. It's like, what the hell does that mean? And but when it does, when the process becomes organic, yes, you know, it does really just happen. And John T. Said to me, a dozen or so years ago, he said, and I remember exactly what he was eating. He said, you know, you cook the best when you think the least about what you're doing.
Yeah, right.
He's like, this is brilliant. He had something, I remember I cooked, it was like Israeli couscous and some pork, and we called it, you know, we just sort of jokingly called it pearls and swine.
Right.
And he said, that's one of the best things I've ever put in my mouth. He goes, what's the story? And I said, I mean, there were just two things that I wanted together, and I wanted it to be simple, and I wanted to be able to taste these four different flavors.
Totally.
And he goes, that's when you're doing your best work.
Well, I don't know if you've had this with dishes, but you know, I've had things where I agonize over, and you know, in hindsight, it's always the same problem. I didn't know really what I wanted to say. Then there are times where I'll have an idea and I'll bang out like a 2,000 word article, you know, like in an hour and a half, you know, and I barely revise it. And it's because I know going in, this is my idea. This is where it ends, you know.
Right.
I know what I want to say. And I think in cooking, it's got to be similar sometimes. I've had people tell me they've had, you know, they've dreamt of a dish and woke up and, you know, couldn't get to the kitchen fast enough and, you know, stuck the landing the first time they tried to make it.
Right. You can cook or you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, from a technique standpoint, and you can certainly learn to do it.
Yes.
You know, because none of us are. You know, I was not born with a whisk in my hand.
Yep.
You know, nor did I. You know, it was just something that I aspired to my entire life.
Right.
You know, but it's my life, it's my love, and you know, and my only regret is that you know I don't get to do it as much now doing what I do as you know as I used to.
Right.
And very selfishly, you know, not because I'm noble, but if I were doing that, I wouldn't have to do a lot of the BS that I have to do. that's not in my comfort zone, but it's what, you know, what needs the greater amount of attention.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you have other places to be. We've talked for quite a while. It's been great. Thank you for doing this.
No, the pleasure was all mine, I
and,
promise you.
If you ever have time when you're in New York, I'd love to do it again. I could talk to you for hours.
I'll be happy to anytime. Because nobody loves to listen to me talk like me.
Good meeting you.
You too, brother.
Thank you. That's our show for today. A huge thank you to John Currents for being our guest and for waiting patiently for this episode to finally air. To Julia Sexton for joining me for the introduction to the show. Thank you, Julia. I really appreciated that. It was quite spontaneous and you were a good sport about it. Thank you to Vitor and Matt, the engineers at Heritage, who have been doing double duty on this show this fall. To Kat Johnson for helping to orchestrate all of that. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening, and we will see you back here in a few days on Andrew Talks to Chefs.